Park Place, Monday afternoon, 13th May 1974. We all know that meditation is a powerful energizer of the whole psyche. All aspects of the psyche, that is to say, all our qualities, become intensified through meditation. That is why it is essential to enter into meditation in as pure a state as possible. You remember how the Buddha points out, or rather I should say lays down, that before you start the deeper aspects of meditation, you set up mindfulness in front of you. Now that's a puzzling phrase, setting up mindfulness in front of you, as if you placed an object at a distance from your eyes. But its real meaning is just this. You direct your attention to the center, the Ajna center, between the eyebrows, just at the back. You know, the pituitary gland is just at the back there. You just direct your mind, you just visualize that inside yourself. And you can quieten the entire body and the flow of thought, any sort of psychical disturbance, pretty quickly with a certain amount of practice. That is setting up mindfulness in front of you. Now this, of course, is the instrument of mindfulness, so to say, this center. And you put aside, and we have discussed the meaning of putting aside day before yesterday, you put aside all lust, pleasures of the senses particularly, cravings and so on, all malevolence and ill will, all sloth and torpor, worry and flurry, and doubt, the carping, the vacillating state of the mind. Not that healthy doubt which is essential for right investigation. And then, in that state, you enter into the other aspects, especially the deep aspects of meditation. Now, in our meditation last week, we directed our attention to the teachers, the Buddha, the Christ, whoever it may be. Now, what is it that actually happens when you turn attention, you let your whole mind and heart flow to the teachers, as we call it? The mind and heart flows towards our particular mental construct of the teacher, our particular picture. We can never escape that. Now, this picture has great potency to energize the whole of the psyche, because through the centuries, the psychical atmosphere is charged with people's devotion and prayers and their concepts about the teacher. Now, since it is the sphere of religion, of devotion, and so forth, the concept of the teacher is about as pure and simple as mankind can make it. You don't think of your beloved in horrible terms. You think in ideal terms. So, this psychical energy which exists in the psychical atmosphere is drawn upon by us when we visualize the teacher and let the mind go towards the teacher in devotion. The qualities which the teacher represents are qualities in ourselves which get intensified. Our qualities, which are the denial of the teacher's perfections, also get intensified. But there is a safeguard. There is this healing influence of the perfections of the teacher upon that aspect of our psyche which is anything but desirable. There's a healing influence, so it helps in that way. This power of devotion, intelligently directed, is a healing power, actually. The difficulty arises when, in everyday life, the provocativeness of the circumstance, the unbearable pressure of the circumstance, knocks us over, and then that which was ill in the psyche suddenly bursts forth again with immense energy. But we can't concern ourselves with that too much at the moment. That one has to deal with through experience. You know how it is. Often and often, one has been through a period of exaltation. Everything seems to be moving as it should move, and one is growing in spiritual stature, and then suddenly something comes along and down we are at the bottom of the well again. And it not only depresses us, it frightens us. We say, if this happens, well, how do we ever get past it? Because it happens again and again, if you're care, if you're watchful. But there's no need to wallow in depression or to run away from the fear that envelops us. One just goes on and on. Now, there's another aspect of this meditation on the teachers. It's not specifically the devotional aspect. And that is the way in which the teachers have been represented through the centuries. And the way in which the God concept has been presented. Because the Supreme Teacher is that which comes under the word God, or if you like, the Supreme Buddha, or whatever term you use. But it stands for the ideal. If you, and particularly in Buddhism, which has no place for any anthropomorphic God concept, no place for a creator God, you find the paramitas the excellent virtues. Param means beyond. You see, the trend, what we call the virtues in their transcendent aspect, no longer in their ambivalent state, where you get the opposite, love, hate, cruelty, kindness, and so forth, but in their transcendent aspect, the absolute aspect, the excellences, the paramitas, as they are called. And they represent what in religions like Zarathustrianism, Hinduism, Christianity, is presented in terms of the characteristics of the divine being. Let me first take a few verses out of the Gita. This is what Sri Krishna says to his disciple Arjuna. Now it is necessary to realize that whilst the Gita is couched in the form of the divine dialogue, just as so many books of the Old Testament, the books of the prophets, is couched in the form of the divine dialogue, and the angel of the Lord moved him to speak, or and so on and so on. You find the same thing in the Upanishads. You find the same thing in the Zarathustrian Gathas. This divine dialogue form is a convenient form to represent your own realization. As and when you have flowered out into the perfect human, you are the embodied transcendence. When you come back to your ordinary state of consciousness, you are John Smith or whoever you are as such. And this divine dialogue is a convenient way of expressing that which you in your transcendent state of union with the ultimate convey to yourself in your ordinary worldly condition. The Gita is supposed to be the divine dialogue between Sri Krishna, one person, this is what the multitudes believe, and Arjuna, the warrior prince, another person. But I say no. The writer of the Gita was a perfected holy one. He had realized the whole thing. Now he expresses that realization in terms of himself in his transcendent state under the name of Krishna, himself in his worldly state under the name of Arjuna. It is the story of every man. This is what these divine dialogues represent. You get the famous conversation with the Lord of Death and by Nachiketas in the Katha Upanishad. Nachiketas and Yamaraja are not two different people. They are one and the same person. The state of realization conveying truth to the state of worldliness in the same person. The author of the Gita is himself Krishna, is himself Arjuna. On some other occasion, I'll pick out the verse where he gives the secret away. Nobody ever seems to have spotted it. I don't know why. However, now Krishna says, I am the father of this universe, the mother, the supporter, the grandsire, the holy one to be known, the word of power. I am the path, the husband, the Lord, the witness, the abode, the shelter, the lover, the origin, dissolution, foundation, house, and the seed imperishable. I give heat, I hold back and send forth the rain. Immortality and also death, being and non-being, am I, O Arjuna. Then a little later, I am the ultimate reality. The word used is Atma. Seated in the heart of all beings, I am the beginning, the middle, and also the end of all beings. And then, time am I, laying desolate the world, made manifest on earth to slay mankind. Not one of these warriors ranged for strife escapeth death. Thou alone shalt survive. Statements like that. The poet of the Gita himself, in supreme communion, has realized all this. You have often heard me say, you are transcendence embodied. When that becomes realization in you, you see all this. It becomes a matter of course. It's just obviously so. And you see what it all implies. That the totality, the wholeness of all existence is embodied in the living particular being. Now, all Hinduistic and particularly Upanishadic presentation, the Gita is called an Upanishad also, you see, you get this type of presentation. Now you look at the presentation as given in the Zarathustrian scriptures. This is one of the long prayers to Ahura Mazda. Ahura Mazda is the Zarathustrian equivalent of the word God. Ahura Mazda, Lord of life and wisdom, Mazda. Lord of life and wisdom. And Zarathustra asks Ahura Mazda, again this divine dialogue, he asks Ahura Mazda that in trouble and in difficulty, when the forces of evil rise up against me, what shall be my armor, my protection, my weapons? These forces of evil, the common folk interpret as people outside, the non-Zarathustrians, who are opposed to the Zarathustrian. The real meaning of the demons and the enemy, and the enemies, the real meaning is my own bad qualities. The turmoil within my own mind and heart. Those are the demons. Those are the armies I have to fight against. You read the Psalms of David. It's the same thing. Thou, O Lord, dost fight for me against my enemies, etc. They are all inside me, not the fellows outside. And Ahura Mazda replies, Ahura Mazda says, our names are your weapons. Very interesting. Our names, the word of power. O holy Zarathustra, I am the sustainer by name. Next, the shepherd. Third, the all-pervading. Supreme righteousness. The whole good creation. The seed of righteousness. Knowledge. Wisdom, holiness, prosperity, the Almighty, the friend of all, the invincible, the just accountant, the all-seeing or omniscient, the healer, the lawgiver, the Lord of creation. Now all these denote the manifestation of the power of the energy of the absolute good within the living being himself. So if one takes these one by one and meditates on them, which means just directs his mind to the word and its significance and lets the mind remain quiet, that particular quality in the psyche becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. This is how it works. You see what an immense field there is with meditation. There is a lot more, but it would take too long. Now, this comes from the Tibetan texts. It's Evans Wentz's translation of a document called the Nirvanic Path. And this is part one of that, and is called Preliminary Yogic Practices. And this subheading is the Tranquility of the Mind. It hath been said, by entirely refraining from forming thoughts and mental visualizations, by maintaining the bodily calmness of a sleeping babe, and endeavoring meekly and zealously to follow the Guru's authorized teachings, there will undoubtedly arise the simultaneously born state. This simultaneously born state is the phrase used to indicate nirvana. Then listen to the next verse. Tilopa, one of the great teachers. There was Tilopa, Marpa, Naropa, and Milarepa. Tilopa hath said, do not imagine, do not think, do not analyze, do not meditate, do not reflect. Keep the mind in its natural state. And this natural state is the state of perfect tranquility, the peace that is not static, But the tranquility which is vibrant, poised equanimity, intensely active, but perfect tranquility. Now this represents one of the peak points of meditation. What happens here? There could be a flow of thought, but it is not your thought, not your discursive thought process. It is a process of observation of all the thought currents that flow past. Like yourself on the river bank, watching the river flow past, without any reaction from you, one way or the other, but a perfect mindfulness, a perfect attentiveness, by which you are in complete communion with that river going past. Now this river is the stream of samsara, the stream of the becoming process, the total becoming process. And you are not for it, you are not against it, you take no sides. Then there arises no conflict of an ambivalent nature. This is desirable, that is undesirable. There is complete at-one-ment with all that is. And this is a transcendent state of the mind, this peace, one of the peak points of meditation as such. It is something to which one climbs ultimately by going through the preliminary stages, which will involve the purification of the mind and the heart by utilizing the qualities as represented which adorn the teacher. Now you all know various qualities which belong to the teachers. You can choose whichever you like, the teacher as well as the quality or qualities, and let the mind dwell quietly upon it for some time. This passage which I read from the Zarathustrian scriptures about the qualities, the names of Ahura Mazda, the descriptive names, represent you yourself in perfection, just as the paramitas as presented in Buddhism, and the long list of virtues, I think there are about 18 mentioned by Sri Krishna in the Gita, towards the end of the Gita, starting with harmlessness and so forth, represent the perfected one. So you take any one of these as you please, and we'll spend a few minutes in letting the mind dwell upon the quality.